This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio and online Main Street across North Dakota. Today we're going to start our show with a subject that's been a subject for our show for a year now, and that's the pandemic and some of the wrinkles that we can iron out and as we increase our understanding about it. We're joined today by Dr. Josh Ranum. He's the vice president of the North Dakota Medical Association, and he's an internal medicine specialist with the West River Regional Medical Center in Hettinger. Dr. Ranum, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks for having me.
How would you describe the pandemic's effect on your practice during the past year?
Well, other than a complete change in how we've done things, it's been business as usual.
Uh-huh.
It's been a really significant impact in how all of us are providing healthcare. Just right around a year ago, I was actually at a national medical association meeting, and you know we had a number of policymakers and things there, and it, you know, COVID was, you know, we maybe spent 10 minutes on it. Nobody was sure even at that time what it was going to do. And then March 2020 comes, and all of a sudden everybody's lives changed. I think the thing that's been the most interesting about this has been the speed of the science and how quickly we've added to our knowledge and, you know, developed new therapeutics, new vaccines, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the prognosis of a COVID infection is totally different now than it was 6 months ago, 12 months ago. It's everything is COVID first, sort of yes or no, and then you kind of move on to the other things. But, you know, in addition to not only the challenges of dealing with the disease itself, we've seen the other, you know, kind of side effects of a pandemic, which is the loneliness and separation in our more vulnerable population, whether that's nursing home or elderly shut-ins. We've seen things that have been delayed because of COVID precautions or a person or a clinician becoming ill. So routine screening things are getting kicked down the road a little bit. So people are coming in a little bit sicker than they maybe would have pre-COVID. They might have come to medical attention earlier. So it's just been a complete shift in pace of care and how we do things. And, you know, fortunately, as we're learning to live with the disease, we're been able to get these folks who need care otherwise, you know, for non-COVID things, you know, back in a timely fashion and try to get back to, you know, the business of regular health care as well.
Remember your first COVID patient?
I do. And, you know, what was, I think one of the more interesting things looking back of how we've dealt with COVID is, you know, the state and this is not, looking back in hindsight or looking back through, the retrospectoscope, but, you know, we shut down as a state and really as a country and when there wasn't many cases here. We think the kids were, you know, schools were shut down when there was one or two cases across the state, you know, not even in the area. So my main area of practice is in Adams County. And so we were the last county in the state to have a positive case. Now I had a couple of positives in some of the other surrounding areas that I treat, but we were several months into it before we started seeing our positive cases. And so, you know, there was a lot of, we had a chance to do a lot of preparation and a lot of work and study on what to do with the COVID positive patients when they show up. Fortunately, we weren't New York or Arizona or some of these places which were thrown into it right away. We had a chance to learn from what was working in other places. But yeah, we started seeing some COVID a few months into the disease, and it was just a, you know, it was a sporadic case here and there, but really ramped up toward the November peak that we were all hoping to avoid.
And that was the circumstance, I think, in a number of healthcare providing facilities around the state. Did you exceed the capacity of West River Regional Medical Center? Did you have to send patients elsewhere?
We did. During the worst of things in November and December, we did run up to our capacity on a few different occasions. We also were working closely with other hospitals and accepting some patients from there. So I talked with colleagues in Dickinson more often in the last 4 months than I have in the previous 4 years. So we had a number of patients that went back and forth. Dickinson was full where they could come down here and vice versa. So there was a point in time where really almost nobody could go anywhere. I mean, it was that tight across the state, and we were certainly no exception to that. Through a lot of cooperation and a lot of phone calls, though, we were generally able to get folks in the right place where they needed to be, whether that was us accepting patients from other hospitals or other emergency departments, or, you know, getting, you know, our more critically ill patients to the level of care that they needed. But it was not something many of us want to go through again.
Dr. Josh Ranum is vice president of the North Dakota Medical Association. He's an internal medicine specialist with the West River Regional Medical Center in Hettinger. Dr. Ranum, you mentioned that in the course of the past year, we have seen some startling advances in medicine, particularly to treat COVID and to deal with the pandemic, like vaccines. I go back to the polio vaccine scares, and that was a far less serious situation than COVID-19, and that's a long time ago, but that was years in development. What have we learned about treating COVID patients during the past year that has improved their outcomes?
Well, we've learned several different things. You know, and the first thing was, you know, these patients come in and they just have profoundly low oxygen levels, and there's in a lot of cases such a disconnect between what the numbers you're seeing and kind of how the patient looks in front of you. So, you know, initially, everybody's reflex was, wow, this is a person who needs mechanical ventilation and high-level oxygen support and all that. And we, you know, eventually learned that, well, maybe we don't have to be quite as aggressive in a lot of these patients. You know, a lot of these patients actually do well with high-level oxygen otherwise. But, you know, in terms of, you know, medications and treatment, it's been a lot of, I mean, people have been able to see the process of science play out in the newspaper. So, you know, you may remember hydroxychloroquine was one of the first things that people thought was going to be a great treatment against COVID-19. And as we got more data and more trials, turns out that really wasn't the case. You know, then it moved on to, you know, something different. The steroids, because this is such a profoundly inflammatory disease, the steroids intravenously were, it's an old medicine that was utilized in the course of COVID, and that really did make a difference for breathing and lung function for a lot of patients. And then as the drug companies and scientists and virologists and everybody worked intensely toward a single focus of disease, it then became unbelievable the things they were able to produce. So not only the vaccines, but the monoclonal antibodies have been a very significant advance in our COVID treatment. And really, the great thing about those is it lets you, you know, before we had to sort of just react and watch and wait and kind of see what the disease did. You know, we didn't have anything that showed a lot of benefit if treated on and jumped on early. But the antibodies, is, you know, administered shortly after a positive test and the onset of symptoms, have really dramatically reduced our hospitalization rate and the risk of severe disease in high-risk patients.
One of the reasons we're talking with you today is because a news release came out recently about monoclonal antibodies and their use in combating COVID-19 infections, especially early in the course of the disease. Now, as I understand it, antibodies are things that show up when a virus is in your body and it's proof that your body is reacting to it. What are monoclonal antibodies?
So, yeah, you hit the nail on the head, Doug. So a monoclonal antibody is a lab produced or, you know, pharmaceutical produced antibody. So it has one target, and it, the way they're produced is mimics the body's way of developing immunity. So these are designed to target the spike protein of the coronavirus molecule, and it does two things as a result of that. So if I was a patient who got that, I would receive the medications intravenously, and I have all these antibodies around searching for targets. And so it binds to the coronavirus virus or the coronavirus molecule. And that does two things. One is it blocks the entry into the cell where the virus actually is active and does its damage. And it also targets that virus for destruction by our immune system. And there's, we think that the more virus in a person's body, the more severe case of COVID they're going to have. And, you know, that makes sense just intuitively. And really what these do is decrease that viral load right away while the body is booting up its own immune response. So it's like a head start for our body's own immune system in fighting COVID. And that's why, you know, the message, the important message with this has been administer these early and, you know, get it in early so it has a chance to do its work and give your body the head start it needs to, in a lot of cases to avoid the hospital in the case of COVID.
You mentioned that one of the things you were seeing as the pandemic progressed was that people were coming in a bit later with more advanced symptoms. So now you're telling people, be aware, if you think you might be positive or have COVID, there is a proactive step you can take with your doctor, and monoclonal antibodies might be one of them.
That is exactly it. And in early in the course of the disease, and I, you know, one of the things I didn't mention, but now that you you hit on it, that it reminded me, it's, you know, there's a lot of folks who in a pre-pandemic time, you know, they were ill, and we would have put them in the hospital and treated them, but when we didn't have any room and they were, you know, COVID positive, it's like, well, yeah, you feel miserable now, but it's you know, day 7 to 10 typically was the worst level of symptoms for patients. And, you know, there was a lot of folks who normally would have been admitted to the hospital, just, all right, go home and try to ride it out and we'll see if it gets worse. I mean, and this was happening across the country, across the world. So it's important to recognize the change in that messaging is that now with some of these antibody therapeutics, that early aggressive treatment can decrease the risk of severe illness. Before these were widely available, we were seeing, and depends on where you're at in the country, but about 8 to 10% of COVID positive patients wound up in the hospital. And with the therapeutics, the monoclonal antibodies, we've seen that number actually drop below 1%.
Wow!
So less than 1% of COVID positive patients who've gotten a monoclonal antibody have landed in the hospital. So that's a, you know, a substantial 80+% reduction in rates of hospitalization. And so, you know, most of the people that are getting severely ill and dying are going through the hospital. So what we've seen is not only less hospital patients, but less severe illness, less death, and less complications with that.
Now, the vaccines for COVID-19 also sort of target that spike in the virus. There has been, you know, a few reports here and there of people reacting to the vaccine, but for the most part, the rollout appears to be an effective vaccine for most people. Are patients in any way resistant to the treatment of monoclonal antibodies?
Yes, there is not a resistance, but there are some caveats about the use of monoclonal antibodies. Actually, a better way of saying it would be there's some caveats with vaccine administration around the receipt of monoclonal antibodies. So, if you get ill and receive monoclonal antibodies, you should not get the vaccine for 90 days afterwards. And there's less concern about reaction, but just more along the lines of the way the vaccines work is they actually cause your body to produce the spike protein. And if you still have these antibodies circulating, theoretically they would gobble up all the spike protein. So it doesn't stimulate your immune system to make that immune response. We certainly have a lot of people who've been worried about, I don't know if I want the antibodies because I want to make sure I get the vaccine. And you know, what I tell them is, you've got a problem now. So one of the analogies I've used is it's kind of like trying to buy flood insurance when the floodwaters are lapping at your door. It's like, no, you have a different problem now. You need this treatment and the vaccine will come later. So if you've gotten the antibodies, you do have to wait 90 days for the vaccine. And that's really just, you're protected until then between your COVID infection and the antibodies. You're very well protected until then. But this just gives your body a chance to actually stimulate an immune response, which is what you're after.
Before COVID-19, were there monoclonal antibodies that were produced for other specific diseases?
There are, and so that's why it's one of the reasons that the pharmaceutical companies were able to ramp these up quickly is there's been a growing use of monoclonal antibodies for different disease states prior to this. These had most utilization in rheumatologic diseases, so rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, and psoriasis, things like that. Also in the GI world with ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, things like that. There's been increasing applications in those autoimmune disease states, as well as the oncology researchers have really developed a lot of monoclonal antibody treatments for different types of advanced stage cancers in the previous, 5 years or so. We've seen a lot more in that. So it's not a brand new technology. They've been around for a while, and the folks that work on these things are increasingly able to quickly specify a new target, which was the case in the COVID-19.
Now, are these relatively easy to make or fast to make? Are they expensive? Are there concerns about, just using too much of it if you don't need to?
They're challenging to make, and because they're actually produced in a cell line, and so it's a biologic process, and so you can only make nature go fast. Expense wise, the COVID specific monoclonal antibodies have actually not been terribly expensive, partly because of cost shifting and, there's all this COVID treatment support and things out there now. So the cost of patients for COVID has been minimal to non-existent, but for example, using Humira or Enbrel for treatment of rheumatoid arthritis, those are those are quite expensive medications administered over the course of the year. And the expense has to do with, of course, their research and development, but also just the difficulties in producing a sufficient quantity.
And as you've mentioned, the monoclonal antibodies are best administered early in the progress of the disease. So are there treatments that have proved effective in later and more serious stages of COVID?
That's a point that bears repeating, is these antibodies have an indication within 10 days of a positive test or onset of symptoms, and also in patients that do not need hospitalization. We think that past that point, it's just too little too late. You've got just so much virus going around, the antibodies don't knock that back. You know, treatments later in the disease are getting better. Since we don't have something that's quite so targeted in COVID-specific, but it's more generalized supportive care. There's a medication called remdesivir, which can help decrease viral load by blocking some of the viral replication. The steroids like dexamethasone, prednisone that we mentioned otherwise. Something called convalescent plasma, we kind of go back and forth on that. It's a similar principle to the monoclonal antibodies, but it's got some indications a little bit later. And the other thing is you know, there hasn't been one specific silver bullet for COVID, but we've gotten a lot better at figuring out what kind of supportive care, meaning what sort of oxygen regimens, what kind of fluid balance to have these folks in, what kind of ventilation settings work best and prevent some of those complications. It's a whole lot easier to fight a fire when it's just in the wastebasket than it is when it engulfs the whole house. So trying to shift the fight early in the course of the disease, prevention, early administration of antibodies is always your best bet than trying to catch it in the hospital.
Well, there's a lot going on with the pandemic, COVID-19, and it's always encouraging to hear some good news, I guess, about treatments and effective follow-through with a disease that has turned everything on its head, as you mentioned mm-hmm. when we started this conversation, Dr. Ranum.
I do just want to add one thing. The North Dakota Department of Health has outstanding resources on their website. And also, they have a staffed hotline as well. So that has a great handout for who is eligible and how to contact if you don't know where to turn regarding whether you are eligible or how to get connected with these infusions.
More information at health.nd.gov. Dr. Ranum, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Ranum is vice president of the North Dakota Medical Association and an internal medicine specialist with West River Regional Medical Center. Coming up on Main Street, a natural North Dakota essay, Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom, and a Plainsfolk essay from Tom Ezern. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Several bills and resolutions are pending in the North Dakota legislature to show support for the state's coal industry. They come in the wake of the decision by Great River Energy to shutter the Coal Creek Station power plant in 2022. Efforts to sell the plant have been unsuccessful so far. One of the resolutions would establish a state policy supporting the reliability and resilience of the power grid, as well as support carbon capture to preserve dispatchable electric generation. Resolution's main sponsor, Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner of Dickinson, told the Senate's Energy and Natural Resources Committee this resolution reflects North Dakota's all-of-the-above strategy when it comes to energy development.
It is the goal, and I underline the word goal, of the North Dakota that the electric providers operate in the state, maintaining and ensuring access to reliable, cost-efficient generation resources. And here again, it says coal, natural gas, hydro, wind, solar, battery technology, and other future technology.
Wardner says the resolution also calls on the regional transmission organizations, the Southwest Power Pool and the Midwest Independent System Operator, to develop pricing mechanisms that are fair when it comes to those dispatchable sources versus interruptible sources. The committee hasn't yet taken action. And a measure calling for electric power reliability and price transparency is now before the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. It's a bill designed in part to help protect North Dakota's lignite industry. It requires all electricity generated in North Dakota is dispatchable or demonstrates backup capacity. It also repeals the 25 by 25 initiative, which was passed to have 25% of electricity come from renewables by the year 2025.
There are three coal-fired power plants. three coal mines, and the Dakota Gasification Synfuels plant in Mercer County. So to say that coal is the lifeblood of our communities, it's almost minimizing how important it is to all of us back home.
And Novak of Hazen appeared before the committee to support the bill.
I'm here today, a lifelong resident of North Dakota, a mother of four, choosing to raise my family here, the wife and the daughter of a coal miner, and a community member that knows that my town will be devastated if we do not take action. Our policymakers, all of you, need to make clear North Dakota wants to keep our baseload power operational.
Opponents, however, cautioned against over-reliance on coal.
Reliability is a function of diversity. This is because all energy sources can and are disrupted.
Ryan Warner is with Lightspring, a Bismarck-based company dealing in solar energy. He told the committee the power problems Texas experienced this week were not as a result of over-reliance on renewables, but baseload coal and natural gas plants failed because they were not prepared for a cold snap.
Accounting for correlated outages like the kind that occurred in Texas and in the Southwest Power Pool this week indicate that generation diversity is the best way to manage unpredictable and severe weather events.
The committee didn't take immediate action on the bill. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Hey kids, do you have a story to tell? Enter it in the 2021 PBS Kids Writers Contest. We're looking for amazing, original stories from writers in kindergarten through the third grade. So tap into your imagination, break out the crayons and magic markers, and start writing today. When you enter, you'll have the chance to win and see your story published online. First place winners in each grade level will receive prizes and have their stories featured on the Prairie Public website. Everyone who enters will get a certificate of achievements. Find the rules and entry forms along with a writer's guide to help you brainstorm and develop plots at prairiepublic.org. The deadline to submit your original story is Friday, April 2nd. The 2021 PBS Kids Writers Contest. Enter today.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. I'm Doug Hamilton. Feeding birds and bird watching are year-round activities for many people, including our natural North Dakota essayist Chuck Lura. Today, he has his eye on a particular small bird, the red-breasted nuthatch.
The comings and goings at our bird feeders has been rather routine this winter. We're getting the usual chickadees, white-breasted nuthatches, pine siskins, downy and hairy woodpeckers on a regular basis. But we are seeing a few red-breasted nuthatches coming in for the suet and sunflower seeds. It's always a treat to see these little feather balls. Like their cousin, the white-breasted nuthatch, they may peck away at the suet for a bit. But when it comes to sunflower seeds, they fly in, pick up one seed, and fly away to eat it in a safe place. It's as if they know they're vulnerable at the feeder and are anxious to get back to protective cover. Most of you are probably familiar with the white-breasted nuthatch. The red-breasted nuthatch is noticeably smaller than the white-breasted cousin. As the name implies, the underside is reddish or rusty colored, and there's a quite distinctive black stripe running through the eye. The white-breasted nuthatch, of course, is one of our more common visitors to the bird feeders throughout the year. They're permanent residents in our area. That's not true for the red-breasted nuthatch. They typically spend their summers in the coniferous forest across much of Canada and the Rocky Mountains. We're near the edge of their winter range, which covers much of the U.S. south and east of North Dakota. Red-breasted nuthatches are also known for their periodic eruptions further south in their normal range if the seed crop of conifers is low. That may be a factor this year. When I'm outside, I can often spot them after hearing their call, which has been described as a nasal ank, ank, ank. Here it is. It's similar to the white-breasted nuthatch's soft and nasal what, with a little higher pitch. By the way, if you need some help with bird calls, you may want to check out the All About Birds website hosted by the Cornell University's Lab of Ornithology, or perhaps iBird Pro app for your cell phone. So listen for the nasal ank, ank, ank when you're outside, and keep your bird feeders well stocked with sunflower seeds and suet. You may discover a new friend, or perhaps renew an old acquaintance. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
Next time on The Pulse, Rodney Smith's wife was dying of cancer, and he was making desperate phone calls.
Just calling and calling and calling.
Trying to get approval for a specific chemo drug.
And they say, well, we're not in charge of that. These people are in charge of that.
And he discovered that he was dealing with a powerful middleman pulling the strings.
What are the rules here? How's this game played?
That's tonight at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and because it's that time of week, Sue Balcom joins us for Main Street Eats.
Sue joins us from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm. Sue, thanks for joining us.
I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
In the middle of February is a time that I start to just lose it in terms of wanting to touch something that feels like warm and alive and outside
and crawling and capable with worms.
Growing and yeah, exactly. Just like if the earth wasn't so covered in snow and frozen solid, like you would just reach down and grab up some dirt, just touch it. I imagine it's about the same for you.
I'm a little spoiled though, because the soil on the top, probably 2 inches of my high tunnels, I guess I haven't been out there when it's been 24 degrees below, but they're warm enough in there that I can still kick a little dirt around. And trust me, I have been like craving that very thing myself. There's something about that warm sunshine that you have this time of year, and the days are getting longer. You know, like I'm like, wow, is the sun coming up? It's only 7 o'clock. It's just time to get going, you know? So I did actually play in the dirt this weekend. I have aloe plants that have just been having babies like crazy. I don't know if it's the quarantine thing and they just don't have anything else to do or what, but I separated my aloe plants and planted whole bunches of them that I'll have to find homes for sooner or later. I just can't throw them away. So I have been thinking about gardening and starting plants, and I'm trying really, really hard not to. But as you know, we are in about zone 4. I think we've talked about that before, and that means you must have some patience when it comes to starting plants this time of year.
Last week we talked about seed packets, and of course you've got to have the seeds to plant. And now we're talking about anticipating, you know, planting indoors for subsequent transplant when zone 4 becomes habitable for new growing plants.
Right. And if you aren't familiar with what those zones are that we're talking about, the USDA has divided the United States up into growing zones, and they're based largely on climate data that we've collected over the past, I don't know how many years. And it's like there's a frost date, guaranteed frost date in North Dakota about the middle of May. And then, of course, in about the middle of September. Now, I realize that those things are moving a little bit. And that's why I think the USDA has actually proclaimed my land to be in zone 4A, meaning that we have a slightly longer growing season. But you don't want to start your transplants too early, although the middle of February is not a bad time to plant peppers. Peppers are a smaller plant. They take longer to germinate. So let's say if you planted something about the 15th of February, they might not come up until the end of the month because it could take up to 10 days for them to germinate. And then you get to watch those little boogers grow bigger and bigger, and they don't mind being a good size when you put in the garden because they're sturdy. Now, I have to be careful about things like tomatoes because my indeterminate tomatoes will vine. They won't grow like a short bush like the hybrid varieties that you're most familiar with. And so they need to be trellised. And last year, holy moly, my plants were growing tomatoes by the time they were in the garden, and it doesn't do them any good. You know, I've said that before. They always all catch up. So if you don't know what your zone is, I understand there's people in Wisconsin and Minnesota that actually listen to this program. I found that out last night. And so if you're in a different part of the country and you're listening to us talk about gardening, you'll want to check out what your zone dates are or what your zone is based on your frost dates from your cooperative extension office.
So what kind of setup do you have?
Before we remodeled our porch, we used to hang lights, and we just used shop lights when we start our transplants. Just basically a warm bulb and a cool bulb inside of a $12 shop light will work. Don't buy a grow light. You don't need that. And we suspended it from the ceiling on chains. So as your plants get taller, you can raise the light, because one of the things that people don't do when they start their plants indoors is give them enough light. Then they get spindly. They're looking for the sun. They're waving back and forth. Then you water them and they'll dampen off because they just don't have a very sturdy torso yet. So get that light down on them. And one of the best ways to do that is to buy a super heavy duty bookshelf, a metal bookshelf. And then we put the trays on the shelf, and then on the shelf above it, we suspend the lights. And that's usually sufficient. Two shelves will get you enough tomatoes and peppers and some flowers to fill a home garden quite easily.
What about heating pads?
You know, I never, ever used one. And now that I have one, I absolutely love it. There's something about keeping that soil warm that those plants just love. Now, when they get to be about the four-leaf stage, I remove them and then use that heating mat for some new starts that I'm working on. And I have these little cell trays that I can get 50 plants in a space of about 10 by 10 inches. So you can start out with them small. It's just that as they grow, you're going to want to transplant them into fresh soil, because I never really fertilize my seeds. A seed has everything it needs to germinate on its own. It doesn't need fertilizer. It just needs warmth and light once it gets up out of the ground. So those plants, once they're up and out of the ground and in the four-leaf stage, then you can probably start transplanting into 2-inch pots or 3-inch pots, whatever you want. You don't have to go too big right away. They don't like that either. And then, of course, when your transplants come up, you can't like let them stagnate. You have to stimulate them a little bit. It makes for stronger bodies. So you brush them and you sing to them, or you put a fan on them. Nice little breeze like they're in the Bahamas. Keep them warm. Keep them in the sun. Most importantly, though, you do have to talk to them, because they really, really respond well to that. We make up little songs too, I guess, but.
Do you buy special soil, or do you just, fill some bags from your garden at the end of the growing season, and then come the middle of March, just put in a little pots in your indoor transplant?
Nope. That's a bad thing to do. When your soil comes in from outside, is not quote unquote sterile soil. So it can have diseases in it. It can have bugs that you don't want in your house in it. I do know somebody that actually would put soil in the microwave and sterilize it that way, but I wouldn't recommend that. If you're married and your wife finds out, look out. So you did what in my microwave? That sounds like something my husband would do with me not looking. But so what you want to do is buy some seed starting soil, if you wish, at the store. I mix up my own. I use 50% of a good sterile potting soil without those little water retention beads in it. I hate those things. And then a quarter peat and a quarter vermiculite. And it gives you kind of a light, fluffy start. If you use that garden soil like you talked about, that can be really heavy when it's wet. And those little plants need air. Yeah. The roots need air to grow. So you can mix your own or buy it. It's not, well, it never used to be very expensive, but things have gotten a little bit out of hand since there's been such great demand for these kinds of things with everybody gardening. But that you know, we had talked about seed sharing before. This would be a good opportunity to buy a peat bundle. They're about $10, and then a bag of vermiculite and a couple bags of good potting soil. And that's, you know, fairly inexpensive. Mix it up in one of those great big storage tubs. And I keep my soil mix in there because I'll do soil blocking in the next couple months. And that way, you know, if a couple of you get together, it's a very cost effective way to get a soil growing medium for your little transplant without having to worry about what you're going to do with the rest of that soil, which, you know, you can throw it on your garden. It works just fine, but it is kind of perfect for growing little tiny transplants. And you don't have to just grow peppers and tomatoes this time of year. You know, you can, like we talked about with the seed packets, take some flowers and check out the seed packets about how many weeks you need to start those before you transplant them. So you can do flowers. I do cabbage early on, cabbage and broccoli and things like that. And then when it gets a little bit warmer outside, I start cucumbers and squash, which isn't always necessary, but you know, it's so much fun. And I do have a greenhouse, so I kind of like to fill that thing up, and then I stand out there in the sunshine going, oh, this is the life.
I love it here.
We can enjoy the indoor growing and wait patiently for our zone 4 window of opportunity to open. Right?
Right on. And it will come sooner than not. And it's so much fun to have those plants in your house. I heard houseplants are actually making a comeback also. You know, plants clean the air for you. So it's a good thing to be surrounded by green. Don't you agree?
I do.
I totally agree. We check in with Sue Belcom for Main Street Eats every Thursday. Always a pleasure, Sue.
Thanks, guys. My pleasure.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Every day, we take for granted engineering marvels like bridges. Imagine life without them. Historian Tom Easern did that with North Dakota's most famous bridge, which was built by the Northern Pacific Railroad to span the Missouri River 140 years ago. It's the subject of today's Plains Folk essay titled, The Northern Passage.
The life and works of Theodore Roosevelt, which North Dakotans are determined to memorialize in Medora, are not without their ironies. Although generally remembered as a man of action, the vigorous life and all that, Roosevelt was indubitably a man of letters, the author of monumental works, including the multi-volume Winning of the West. As an author, T.R.'s model was Francis Parkman, whose own multiple volumes celebrated the struggle in the wilderness that determined the fate of North America. Parkman, like T.R., but a generation earlier, came west for adventure as well as knowledge. Here society is reduced to its original elements, Parkman declares, although, you know, in my mind, I hear the words in Roosevelt's tenor. The whole fabric of art and conventionality is struck crudely to pieces, and men find themselves suddenly brought back to the wants and resources of their original natures. Well, Parkman and Roosevelt alike, too, understood the significance of passages, personal and physical. Parkman marked the passage by which Anglo-American humanity punched through to the wilderness at South Pass. For Roosevelt, a generation later, that passage was the Northern Pacific Railroad bridge spanning the Missouri River at Bismarck. Without which, nothing, or not much, anyway. Without the NP bridge, no capital at Bismarck, possibly no state of North Dakota. No open-range cattle industry on the northern plains. No President Theodore Roosevelt, since he himself declared that if not for his experience here, he never would have been president. The historian Lounsbury dates the beginning of ranching in the Badlands to 1881, with the importation of 200 Eastern cattle and the establishment by Wadsworth and Hawley of the Maltese Cross, the outfit they soon would sell to Roosevelt. I presume these were shorthorns, and that they crossed the Missouri River on the ice, or by rail on the ice bridge at Bismarck. Longhorns were regarded as inferior by this time. Eastern cattle and Eastern connections were required, which materialized with completion of the NP Bridge in October 1882. Cattle, blooded cattle, sometimes called states cattle, poured across, and with them, cattlemen with pedigrees of their own. Roosevelt, with his hunting expedition of 1883, made possible by the bridge since he arrived by the NP Railroad, illustrates the connection between the tourist industry, also established by virtue of bridge completion in 1882, and the cattle business. He was preceded by a few months by the Marquis de Moray. We know much of the early activities of these fellows through reports published in the Badlands Cowboy, the editor of which, Arthur T. Packard, was able to bring a printing press to Medora, well, because the NP had bridged the Missouri. In The Cowboy, I read, for instance, of Roosevelt's receipt of 1,500 head of states yearlings and twos for his Elkhorn and Chimney Butte ranches in May 1885. Issue after issue, too, displays the placement of registered brands on drawings of cattle that are definitely not longhorns. Roosevelt arrived too late to observe the astonishing construction techniques deployed by the engineer who built the bridge, George Shattuck Morrison. These have been documented in fascinating fashion for North Dakota history by the geologist Edward C. Murphy. We do not know whether Roosevelt learned about Morrison's work in the 1880s, but we do know, by virtue of the research of Kurt Eriksmoen, that Morrison went on to become the most distinguished bridge builder in America, and that it was he, with his work on the Panama Canal Commission, who convinced Roosevelt to build the canal in Panama. Roosevelt loved technology, and he loved antiquities, and he believed in bold executive action. The Northern Pacific Bridge at Bismarck needs a Teddy Roosevelt today. Where will we find one?
That's Tom Ezern. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 18th. It was on this date in 1735 that the first opera performance in America took place in Charleston, South Carolina. As North Dakota entered statehood in 1889, many of its towns boasted opera houses, where rough-hewn farm families could enjoy higher culture. When North Dakota's first governor spoke at the dedication of the Metropolitan Opera House in Grand Forks in 1890, he declared, "The formal opening of this magnificent auditorium, which is this night dedicated to music and the thespian arts, puts behind us the primitiveness of the frontier." The audience of ladies in black silk and gentlemen in evening attire applauded with delight. Like others who gathered in similar North Dakota theaters and in small-town structures ornate only in name, they felt they were entering upon a new era of cultural advancement. Many stage personalities from New York performed in the larger opera houses. Al Jolson played his first individual role at the Grand Theater in Fargo. Boris Karloff, for over a year, appeared in plays every week at the Jacobson Opera House in Minot. Operas, vaudeville shows, boxing and wrestling matches, home talent productions, lectures, political rallies, graduations, and concerts all took place in the opera houses, which served as entertainment centers
until movie theaters replaced them. Among the few opera houses that still survive, the Fargo Theater has received a complete renovation, including the restoration of its mighty Wurlitzer pipe organ. In 1879, an Englishman, Finlay Dunn, was in the audience. He wrote that the performances were seen by large numbers of dark-visaged farm fellows with slouch hats, many with blue guernseys, some lumberers in red flannel jackets, an occasional Indian, and many mixed bloods. In Devil's Lake, the privileged son of a wealthy financier built a three-story menswear store in 1892 and turned over the second floor to his wife so she could indulge her passion for opera. Some of the original features of this opera house include a majestic staircase and classy, ornate, metal-cased bay windows on the north side facing 4th Street. It's now the Opera House Apartments and is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. The Ellendale Opera House suffered a partial collapse of its roof in 2001. Thankfully, the building has been saved. Other opera houses may be intact around the state, but sadly, most fell into disrepair or were converted for other uses. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Mary Helm. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Last week, the CDC released new guidance on when and how to reopen schools during the pandemic, but some experts say those recommendations are flawed.
How is it that restaurants and bars and even indoor water parks in some states are open, and casinos for that matter, and schools are not?
Why kids aren't in classrooms yet, on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast or stream, you can find any Main Street show right there at prairiepublic.org. Friday on Main Street, we'll get an update on efforts to save the historic rail bridge that was the subject of Tom Ezern's Plainsfolk essay today. We'll hear about it from Mark Zimmerman, president of Friends of the Rail Bridge. News director Dave Thompson will join us to talk about the week's big stories, and Matt Olean will review Land. It's a new movie about a woman's search for meaning in the American wilderness. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.